With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Sabrina Halvorsen.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us today on the AgNet News Hour. Coming up later, Hass avocados are removed as a host in Oriental fruit fly quarantine, but our top story today, during a newsmaker session here at the NAFB convention in Kansas City, Missouri, USDA Undersecretary for Trade and Foreign Agricultural Affairs, Alexa Taylor, shared her goals in 2024.
They all really fall under one big purview, and that is continuing the work that I talked a little bit about in rebuilding confidence in the benefits that trade can bring to U.S. agriculture. That's spending time with our specialty crop sector. We're going to be doing, under the Specialty Crop Competitiveness Initiative that I mentioned, a series of roundtables. We have a Federal Register notice open right now where we're taking comments. We want to identify the gaps on the administrative side that we control at USDA and to better serve our specialty crop sector. We'll be doing a series of roundtables, both virtually and in person, so getting out and meeting with those producers and hearing about the challenges that they have. Obviously, they are well organized on the Farm Bill side of things and have, under the Specialty Crop Farm Bill Alliance, I think there will be, you know, a set of priorities that they're asking for and pushing Congress for in the short term. I think also continuing to invest in this market diversification work. We will be announcing our 24 trade missions in very short order as well. And I think when you see the list, it very much rings true to expanding our footprint, investing in some of those key regions. And I think they will really complement the RAP program and the dollars that the industry can really tap into to help not ignore our top markets. We have those traditional Farm Bill programs, MAP, FMD for that, but to help be able to expand beyond it. Because one of the things we've heard as the ATP is ending next year is a curtailment of some of the activities that our cooperators and the industry had started to do in places like Southeast Asia, in places like Africa. And so this really will allow them to focus additional resources and not only have to focus their resources on kind of their top few markets.
Taylor gave a status update on trade disputes under the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement regarding Canada's dairy TRQ allocation measures and Mexico's ban on the use of biotech corn in tortillas.
They are both in process. We're coming towards the end on the Canada dispute. One thing I think is really important as we maybe step back from the specific Mexico biotech dispute, Canadian dairy dispute, is why we're doing them. As I think about really showing the value of trade, building confidence in what trade can bring, trade agreements are important tools, but enforcing those trade agreements so they're not just words on a piece of paper, but actual commitments to our industry, I think is a cornerstone to that work and that effort. And so I think these disputes are key as going forward as we continue to invest in rebuilding that confidence in the value and the benefits of trade. I will say also, I think it's important to remember that this is our second Canadian dairy dispute. We won. We were very successful on the first. We don't want to lose that in hindsight, that we were successful. The second dispute was really to narrow focus. And that one is coming soon, I think, will be concluded. Next year, we expect the initial panel reports, I think, on the Mexico dispute.
In other news, U.S. wheat price prospects are continuing to fall. Here's Gary Crawford with more.
When it comes to the prices U.S. wheat growers are expected to get this marketing year, we are looking at
pretty sharp year-over-year declines.
USDA Outlook Board Chairman Mark Jekinowski, USDA just recently chopped another dime off its forecast for average wheat prices, taking it down to $7.20 a bushel. That's $1.63 lower than a year ago. Several reasons for those falling prices.
Production is up, but also exports continue to be historically low. The U.S. has not been very competitive in export markets lately, and we're at about a 50-year low in terms of our exports. So with higher production and relatively lower global demand for U.S. wheat, that's been pressuring prices.
In percentage terms, U.S. wheat production is up 10%, exports expected to fall by 7%, and that $7.20 a bushel price would be 18% below a year ago. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
This is the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. We will return in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports, including our livestock report with Randall Wiseman when we return. You're listening to the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson, and I am broadcasting from the National Association of Farm Broadcasting Convention in Kansas City, Missouri. Let's go to some of my fellow farm broadcasters from around the country for today's national spotlight, starting with one I know well, Rusty Halverson.
The Beef Checkoff-funded Trailblazers program is seeking applications for its next class of beef advocates. Trailblazers, developed by the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, takes advocacy to the next level by giving participants the tools and training they need to promote beef to new audiences while addressing and correcting myths. Applications will be accepted through December 8th, and selected participants will be notified mid-January upon completing the review process. You can learn more and apply at ncba.org. Speaking of meats, or in this case, natural meat imitators, Believer Meats is building the world's largest cultured meat factory in Wilson, North Carolina. Construction is ongoing with a ribbon cutting expected next summer. Gustavo Berger is CEO of Believer Meats.
The process is producing meat from animal cells. We go for the extraction of the cells, which is called fibroblasts, and we grow these cells, providing them all the nutrients that they need as the animal body that contains amino acids, contain vitamins, and we grow those cells in a very controlled environment in moving from flasks to tanks. And the biggest tank is called bioreactor. It looks like a fermentation tank. Once the cell reaches a specific density and growth in that tank, we harvest that product. It goes through a washing process to separate what are the nutrients and ingredients in the cells, and then we have the biomass. Part of what we harvest comes back to the tank for the next production cycle. So after that harvesting process, we have the biomass, which is the basis of the meat. And then from that, we get to the final product.
From his perspective, Berger says the end product is real meat.
It's meat made out of animal cells. It brings the same experience as traditional meat in terms of taste, texture, coloring. Delivers the same healthiness, even better, because we have much less saturated fats, we have much less cholesterol, and it's real meat. This is not plant-based, which is a different category. This is real meat.
He says the goal is to make it possible for future generations to eat meat.
We are here as an end company. We are not here as an or company. We are not here to force people to eat meat. We are just an element or a conduit to help to solve the problem of supply demand that we have already now in terms of protein. And we are very proud that in Believer Meats we have immortalized cells of many different species. So chicken is just the beginning. We have lamb, we have pork, we have beef, all the portfolio for those who are meat lovers.
Products will be available starting with cultured chicken next year.
That's today's National Spotlight. Now here's Randall Wiseman with today's livestock report.
Well, in today's livestock news, the joint annual meeting of the National Milk Producers Federation and its checkoff partner groups, National Milk and Dairy Management Incorporated, was held this past week in Orlando, Florida. At the event, NMPF Chairman Randy Mooney commended U.S. dairy farmers for their persistence in supporting positive change for their industry, noting that challenges are nothing new to producers and that their unity has brought progress in encouraging better federal farm policy. Mooney said, "We're nourishing families around the world through milk's unbeatable nutritional value. I've dairied for a long time through good times and bad times, but there's never been a time that I haven't laid my head down on a pillow at night and been proud of what I accomplished on my own farm." Now, dairy producers in the past year have faced operating margins at their lowest level since the Federal Dairy Safety Net was adopted in its current structure in 2014 as prices plummeted from record highs. Meanwhile, the U.S. Farm Bill has expired and dairy farmers are seeking a fair milk pricing system through a USDA-led Federal Milk Marketing Order FMMO hearing, which began back in August and will resume on November 27th after a temporary pause. Following Mooney on stage was NMPF President and CEO Jim Mulhern. Of course, he's retiring at the end of this year after leading the organization for a decade. In his remarks, Mulhern reflected on the challenges that dairy farmers have met. He said, "I've tried to remain true to what I see as the hallmark of the dairy community, people who work hard, approach things with common sense, care passionately about the product they produce." He said, "You all strive to do the right thing, and I can tell you, looking over the course of my career, those are the qualities that can take you a very long way." Along with adopting official federal policy positions, NMPS membership also raised funds for the organization's college research scholarships and held its annual Cheese for Dairy Product Contest in conjunction with the meeting. To learn more about the meeting, simply go to the National Milk Producers Federation website, nmpf.org. And USDA's decision to accept beef imports from Paraguay for the first time in 25 years will likely not change the overall volume of U.S. imports, even during tight supplies and high prices. U.S. meat importers are telling Reuters that due to a quota on shipments, American beef prices set records this year because of herd contraction to its smallest level in decades. As a result, meat companies are relying on more imports to process enough ground beef to meet demand. Now, Paraguay did not negotiate with the U.S. to sell beef under its own quota agreement. That means it has to compete with other countries in the same situation to fill a group of tariff rate quota. The quota for these countries, including Brazil, Ireland, Japan, and Namibia, is approximately 650,000 metric tons. Suppliers already filled that quota earlier this year, and suppliers face a steep 26% tax on the value of products that have been shipped above that quota. I'm Randall Wiseman for Agnet West.
Don't forget, if you have missed any of our morning shows or simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search Agnet NewsHour on your favorite podcast downloading app. We will be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we come back. Coming up in a few moments, we'll have today's This Land of Ours report, but first, more of the day's agriculture news. And with today's Agnet West headlines, here's Brian German.
Hass avocados have been removed as a potential host in oriental fruit fly quarantines. Back in September, the U.S. Department of Agriculture and the California Department of Food and Ag established an oriental fruit fly quarantine in San Bernardino and Riverside counties, impacting avocado production regions. Initially, Hass avocados were listed as a host contrary to USDA's list for Mediterranean and Mexican fruit flies. The California Avocado Commission notified the USDA of the inconsistency, leading to the removal of Hass avocados from the host list late last month. The change eliminates mandatory treatment requirements for Hass avocados on trees in the quarantine area, resulting in significant cost savings for growers. However, other avocado varieties in the quarantine zone will still need to adhere to treatment protocols. The commission is also collaborating with USDA to exclude Hass avocados from the Queensland fruit fly quarantine. The U.S. Department of Agriculture is launching a new initiative to support the specialty crop sector, aiming to enhance its competitiveness and create better markets for American farmers. USDA conducted a comprehensive review of its services for specialty crops, resulting in the creation of a Specialty Crops Resource Directory, providing a centralized source of information for producers and businesses. Over the coming months, USDA plans to engage directly with the industry for feedback on addressing service gaps. Stakeholders are encouraged to submit comments on how USDA can better support and meet the needs of the industry. Comments are due by March 8, 2024. Furthermore, USDA is investing $70.2 million in the Specialty Crop Research Initiative, supporting 21 projects addressing national agricultural challenges, including pest management, production efficiency, and food safety hazards. Bearing acreage of wine grapes still needs to be addressed as demand continues to remain flat. President of Allied Grape Growers Jeff Bitter said that acreage was reduced by about as half as much as was initially recommended over 4 years ago, but there's still concern moving forward.
We've actually been getting by because we've had short crops the last 3 years. 20, 21, and 22 are all less than the historical average crush size. So even though those acres are still in the ground, our overall production was down to the point, you know, as if the acres weren't there. So that's kind of the concern going forward is, you know, still this realization and reality that those acres are still in the ground. We're actually still struggling to keep balance in the market, even with the lighter crops the last 3 years. And so that points to a need of, you know, to reduce acres even more. Even though we haven't seen the maximum production we could see on those acres, we're still, you know, technically oversupplying ourselves in this state of the market today. So, you know, I think this winter there's going to be another call for reduced acres so that we can achieve balance in a shorter time frame. If we were to depend upon demand to increase, that takes time. You know, that's nothing that we can change or we can control any kind of short-term time frame, but supply is something we can control in the short term. So that's where we need to look to adjust to bring ourselves into balance here.
EPA is looking for a more refined way for ESA reviews on registered products. President and CEO of the Almond Alliance, Aubrey Betancourt, said there are several proposals that are being discussed.
Each of those is a proposal to say, this is how we believe we can more quickly and categorically do the Endangered Species Act review of any chemistries registered. There's a number of things in there that are different. It's changing risk-based assessments. It's really altering the way these products are looked at in many ways. One of the things that we are particularly focused on is there is this gap between EPA and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And so under these new regs that EPA is proposing, the Almond Alliance and a number of other agencies have been deeply engaged to try to come up with some mechanism so that EPA can actually acknowledge Fish and Wildlife's authority in this space and to say, you know what, there's actually good progress on the books that doesn't need to fall under new regulation.
The American Pistachio Growers 2024 Pistachio Industry Annual Conference is scheduled for February 26th through the 28th at the Monterey Conference Center. The three-day event will unite pistachio industry members from all over the globe for networking and education. This year, the conference will host several events, including the annual golf tournament, which benefits the APG Federal and State Pistachio Pack, and the annual APG Pack Breakfast, where attendees will hear about updates on the work that's being conducted. Presentations throughout the conference will feature information about the overall state of the industry, including APG's global marketing efforts and government relations updates. World-renowned economist and financial expert Dr. Marcy Russell will also be a keynote speaker with a global economic outlook presentation featuring opportunities for growth. More information about the conference is available on the upcoming events page at agnetwest.com.
Don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or just need to catch the news at a different time, you can subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search Agnet News Hour on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's Agnet News Hour, and it is available on both Apple and Android devices. This is the Agnet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson, and we will be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines. Welcome back to the Agnet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Many communities don't have trees and forested areas for their residents, but there is a major effort to change that. Gary Crawford has more about it on this edition of Agriculture USA.
Green space, the final frontier of health and wellness? Well, it might not be the final frontier, but a very important one for sure. Important enough for the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Forest Service to invest a lot of money in it, because when it comes to access to green space, to a little bit of nature, especially for urban cities and towns,
no community should be left behind.
Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack announcing recently a $1 billion national investment for 385 projects to plant trees and increase access to green space for millions of Americans who don't have that access. Coming up, we'll dig a little deeper into this on this edition of Agriculture USA. I'm Gary Crawford.
Trees.
Throughout history, songwriters have been inspired to write poems and songs praising trees. Amongst the worst is this melody.
Trees, a home for birds and bees. We all need our trees.
Yes, we do need our trees. A lot more than we need some of these songs about. Okay, that's enough. Songs about trees. Now, most of us would agree trees are generally nice to look at. They add a certain beauty to a place. But Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack says the $1 billion investment for projects to plant trees and increase access to green space for those who don't have it is not just a beautification program, rather a life-saving one, especially with the climate warming up and many cities this past summer suffering record-breaking deadly heat, made worse and more deadly because of the lack of tree cover. And Vilsack told reporters,
a tree canopy can reduce temperatures by anywhere from 11 to 19 degrees.
In doing so, they can also help lower energy costs for consumers. We know that trees soak up CO2 and other pollutants and therefore have a mitigating effect on the impacts and the adverse impacts of the climate crisis. They provide better air quality and so provide healthcare benefits, certainly in terms of people who are suffering from asthma and other lung-related diseases.
And that is not just a theory. These conclusions are based on large-scale scientific studies. I'm going to pull up a story now that I did a while back with a Forest Service researcher, Michelle Kondo. She told us about a long-term study, 9 million people, 7 cities around the world, in which researchers matched up their addresses with what kinds of green spaces were nearby. They also checked birth and death records for those folks, and the results were astounding. Very simply,
people live longer when they live in greener environments. With a greener neighborhood, your risk of premature mortality goes down.
Michelle and her colleagues have done some studies that give us at least a clue as to why people seem to live longer in areas with trees and greenery. Michelle says Philadelphia has a lot of vacant lots and such, which can be not only very ugly, but sometimes dangerous. So with that in mind,
we asked a set of residents to wear heart rate monitors and to walk around their neighborhood. We asked them to walk twice, both before and after some of the vacant lots had been cleaned up and we planted some trees and grass. And we found their heart rates were significantly lower when they were in view of these greened vacant lots.
And of course, it's probably some sort of mental or emotional reaction, which brings us to another study that Michelle did.
We measured people's moods, emotions. We tracked their location throughout their day, and they would receive little pop-up messages on their phones to answer our very brief survey about their mood or emotions.
And the results when people were near or around trees and such?
Positive emotions were improved and negative emotions decreased compared to, for example, if they were indoors or not somewhere near some trees.
But, of course, the problem is that many towns and cities don't have the resources to create green spaces, plant the trees, maintain the trees. It's those places to which these new projects are targeted because
everyone should have access to nature.
That's Brenda Mallory. She is chair of the White House Council on Environmental Quality.
We have lots of data now that show us that these benefits of nature can provide for our communities are both physical but also mental health and also addressing our local economies and creating good-paying jobs.
Mallory says President Biden has set a goal to cut in half by the end of the decade the number of people who don't have access to parks and nature. And so Agriculture Secretary Vilsack says in doing that,
we believe that we can create more resilient communities in terms of the impacts of climate. We can mitigate extreme heat incidences and events in many of the cities where projects and awards will be made.
Vilsack said most of the projects will be in underserved communities where residents have little or no access to green spaces. You've been listening to Agriculture USA. I'm Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington.
With the Congressional Ag Committee leadership announcing an extension of the 2018 Farm Bill, this becomes the latest in a series of recent farm policy legislation that took longer than expected to complete. Here's Rod Bain with more.
With congressional activity this fall focused on several items, including passage of a new federal budget, there has been concern of late if a new farm bill would be approved by the House and Senate and signed into law by the president in 2023. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack in early November offered his opinion on the fate of a new farm bill this year.
We're not going to have a farm bill passed before December 31st.
And just this past weekend, chairs and ranking members of both Senate and House Agriculture Committees announced a one-year extension of the 2018 Farm Bill. Secretary Vilsack previously said an extension, if a new farm bill was not reached by the end of this year, would be needed and essential.
Because we don't want the program to lapse, because if it were to lapse, there would be serious consequences to the farmers, but also very serious consequences to the economy and to consumers.
This would not be the first time a farm bill failed to become farm law on a timely manner. As University of Illinois professor and former USDA Farm Service Agency Administrator Jonathan Koppus explains,
typically it does take more than one Congress in 1 year to get a farm bill done. So if in fact we get into extension territory or this drags out past 2023, we are not in an anomalous situation.
Koppus spoke at a recent Farm Foundation forum on a new farm bill and what it might contain. In terms of examples of farm bills that were crafted past the year of originally intended date of completion,
the FAIR Act Farm Bill in 1996 began in 1995, complicated by budget issues. What became the 2002 Farm Bill really began being debated in 2001, so that stretched over multiple years. Again, what became the 2008 Farm Bill started in 2007. And the current record holder for the longest stretch is the Farm Bill. It got enacted in early 2014, and it really began in 2011. And was supposed to have been reauthorized in 2012. And then the 2018 Farm Bill is actually the only one in recent history that has been reauthorized within the year of the expiration.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or just need to catch the news at a different time, you can subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search Agnet News Hour on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's Agnet News Hour, and it is available on both Apple and Android devices. This is the Agnet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson, and we will be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines. Welcome back to the Agnet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. I am reporting this week from the National Association of Farm Broadcasting Annual Convention in Kansas City, Missouri. Here I talked with USDA Natural Resources Conservation Chief Terry Cosby, and that is today's interview segment. What are some key topics that you would like our listeners to know?
Well, you know, one of the things is that NRCS had a very successful year in 23 in those states, and we're looking forward to 24. And one of the things that we're trying to do is look at, we had such a huge amount of oversubscription of our programs. And now with all of the new funding that we have, especially through IRA and the bipartisan infrastructure law, we have an opportunity to service a lot more customers. And so we're out there right now talking to a lot of new customers that might want to come in and participate. So things are very positive. A lot of great work happening, especially in those states.
You know, we have some good relationships with NRCS in our various states, especially in our southeast region, Florida, Alabama, Georgia, and we air stories every week from our local NRCS agencies. Having you in D.C. and then, you know, imagining the tree that spreads out with all the different branches, with you being in charge of all of that, what is it like for you keeping everything coordinated and making sure you know what's going on all over the nation?
That's when you have to surround yourself with good folks. Yeah. But we have a great staff. You know, we have about 11,000 employees across the country. We have 52 organizational units, and I've worked in a lot of these places. I'm from Mississippi, so I understand the South, the Southeast, the Northeast. I worked there. I worked out West in Idaho. So it you know what, NRCS is one big happy family, and we have something for every farmer across the nation. We love working with stewards. I call farmers steward because they are stewards of these farms. And we want to be there with them to make them successful. We want to make them be profitable. We want to make sure that they have these farms for generations and they can pass them on to their children. And conservation works. It is a thing that will help for generations to make sure they're still profitable and they can get through these difficult times, especially in times of climate and drought and all the things that are happening right now.
What are some things that you have seen progress or change or some positive things that are going on that you've seen just while you have been in charge of NRCS?
You know, this is my 44th year working at USDA, and I was state conservationist in Ohio, state conservationist in New Hampshire for a while, and I've seen so many changes. I've been here half as long as the agency has been here, about 90 years, and some days I feel it, you know. But, you know, I've seen such tremendous change. Just over the last few years that I've been there, the streamlining of these programs, you know, I get a lot of folks talking to me and saying, it's too complicated. It's too much. How do we change this? And so I really, really talked to the staff about how do we streamline programs, how we make them accessible, because these new customers and a lot of the new technology we have today, folks don't want to go through all of these things. And so the staff is really working on hard to look at how do we streamline, how do we change them, how do we be more flexible. When we talk about our conservation standards, we have so many folks out there that have a lot of expertise. So how do you incorporate that into what we do every day? And it's a partnership between us and the public to make sure that we're providing that great service. And so it's been, I tell you what, I came into this in 21, day one, with the Biden-Harris administration as acting chief, and it's been wonderful just to see the progress we've made. And I'm the 17th chief, and from Hugh Hammond Bennett in the early 30s to myself now, It has been. I just can't explain it. I can't believe I get to do this every day.
Is there anything else you'd like for our listeners to know?
No, please come see us. We have over 2,500 offices across the country. The staff is right now in the middle of taking sign up and looking at, you know, these applications. And if you're interested in receiving a little financial assistance to do these programs out there, please come in and see us.
Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you again to USDA Natural Resources Conservation Service Chief Terry Cosby. This is the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson, and we will return in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back to the AgNet NewsHour. Here's Rusty Halverson.
The United States Trade Representative recently announced that the U.S. and India reached an agreement to lower tariffs on U.S. turkey exports to India. The agreement will lower tariffs on frozen turkey product exports to India from 30% to 5%. U.S. Trade Representative Catherine Tai visited North Carolina State University's Turkey Education Unit to make the announcement.
Taking a tariff from 30% down to 5% is going to be a huge cost incentive. And I think that it will also be an opportunity for the United States and North Carolina in particular to showcase turkeys and turkey meat to the people of India.
Tai says it also helps the U.S. address the issue of food insecurity around the world.
We have extremely efficient, productive producers. We produce on the basis of science. We regulate on the basis of science and risk, and we are promoting that kind of approach around the world, and we will take the tariff breaks wherever we can accomplish them with a trading partner.
Tai says it's another step that will serve to spark growth in the poultry industry.
What we really want to see is that this helps to grow the turkey industry produce benefits here so that our producers can be larger parts of the community and can support all the other aspects of the community, the small businesses, the opportunities where they are operating, where they're growing their turkeys.
As part of the deal, tariffs on frozen duck, fresh blueberries and cranberries, frozen blueberries and cranberries, dried blueberries and cranberries, and processed blueberries and cranberries have also been reduced.
AI looks to be a big part of the future technology, and it's already starting to play a role in major agricultural companies. David Geiger has this report.
The Senate Agriculture Committee hosted a hearing on AI and innovation into American agriculture. In her opening statement, Senator and Chair Debbie Stabenow points to agriculture's role in technology.
American agriculture has always been at the forefront of innovation, and artificial intelligence has the potential to revolutionize the way we grow, harvest, and distribute our crops. In this rapidly evolving landscape, it is imperative that we strike a balance between harnessing the benefits AI offers while addressing the concerns it raises.
Concerns like data privacy, workforce implications, and equitable access to the technology. Stabenow says the reality is AI is already being integrated into our daily lives.
In fact, I'm going to pause. My statement up to this point was entirely generated by AI, and it's something I would have said. So it's incredible, actually, to me.
Panelist Dr. Mason Earls with the University of California, Davis defines AI.
So put simply, an AI is a computer program that takes in one or more inputs, like an image or an audio recording or table of data, and outputs some prediction or physical action.
Earls explains the process to predict something like an invasive weed. They would train the AI by showing examples of pictures with and without the weed and offer yes or no options, with penalties for failure. They then repeat the process until it has a good enough performance rate. Some members of the committee were curious about how far along AI is, like this exchange between New Mexico Senator Ben Ray Lujan and Dr. Earls.
Is there a workforce ready to fully develop and operate these technologies so that farms across the nation can fully benefit?
The workforce is probably not as there in specialty crops, for example, as it may be where we have much more manual labor. And so there's a lot more difficult types of tasks humans are doing. I think maybe we're closer on the front where we already have major penetration of mechanization. So in some of the row crops and things like that, where maybe there's less manual labor, I think that's probably the biggest differentiator in my mind of what drives readiness for the workforce.
Right, I appreciate that. And Madam Chair, I think that's just a reminder that the committee not lose sight of the human component.
That human component is important. Chair Stabenow says as the USDA looks into this cutting-edge technology, they must be cautious about significant risk.
Placing vast amounts of data in the hands of a few private companies could accelerate the trend of consolidation or perpetrate biases that have harmed small farmers. High costs are putting AI and precision agriculture technology out of their reach for everyone except the largest operations.
Ranking member of the committee John Bozeman also wants to watch for dangers. He says AI has potential but needs to answer tough questions.
New regulations may be needed to ensure that consumers are kept safe, especially when it comes to the use of applications that handle sensitive data.
On how to make law, Todd Jansen, president of Jansen Schroeder Agricultural Law, was on the panel and came with three legislative considerations for the committee.
I think that any policy should focus on leveling the playing field and not stifling innovation because this is such an innovative sector. Second, when I think trust is lacking, then transparency becomes even more important. And so if anyone is collecting data and they don't have that farmer trust, they have to be extremely transparent with how they're using it. And finally, any platform that uses agricultural data should try to return an equal or greater value of that data back to the farmer in the resulting product.
Bozeman says the U.S. leads the world in innovation, with a third of major tech business located here.
Since the beginning of the technological revolution, America exercised a light touch approach toward regulating this budding industry, while others like Europe took a different approach. We must determine if that approach is appropriate when it comes to regulating AI and its uses in agriculture.
Reporting on the Senate Agriculture Committee, I'm David Geiger.
Corn price prospects are down as growers harvest a record large crop, larger than many had expected. Gary Crawford reports.
Corn growers are wrapping up the harvest of what USDA says will be a record large crop, up 11% from last season. As to what's going to happen to that crop.
Really, all of the major use categories we expect to go up,
including feed use, ethanol production, and exports. USDA Outlook Board Chairman Mark Jekanowski says all those uses will be up from a year ago, but not up enough to prevent a sizable 58% buildup in year-ending stocks. And that prospect is certainly affecting corn prices.
The market prices are low. We can see that in the futures markets and the cash prices that farmers are receiving right now.
Last year, growers got an average price $6.54 a bushel.
And right now, as of November, we're forecasting $4.85 per bushel, so down about almost $1.70 from last year.
A 25% drop in price. As one Iowa producer told me the other day, yes, prices are down. He hopes to make up some of that in volume. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
That's today's top agriculture news. I'm Sabrina Halverson reporting this week from the National Association of Farm Broadcasting Annual Convention in Kansas City, Missouri. Thank you for sharing your morning with us.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Danielle Leal, Brian German, and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet NewsHour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.